But thank you all for joining us. I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Julia Chapman, who is part also of the University of Southampton. Julia is working, is a Blue Humanities Scholar, and I think of as pioneering in her work in relation to thinking about ocean governance, particularly. We connected through the Ocean Justice Reading Group that she has been running, which is a new reading group in the university. But it's also bringing together many people who are interested in some of these topics. And of course, this also resonated deeply with the water theme, as I mentioned, that we're hosting with Kubu. The format for the conversations are, you know, informal in a sense. Julia and I had the opportunity to meet a couple of weeks ago for the first time when Kajsa Molgaard was also with us, sharing her practice on her creative practice around oceans and the wonderful work that she does in relation to, I think, speaking on behalf and thinking with and being with the water body that is the ocean. So it was really beautiful to also host that conversation. So, Julia, how did you get into this field of practice? I think that would be a first sort of starting point. And what brought you to do work so deeply with oceans?
Yeah, thank you, Theresa, for having me. Thank you, the whole lab and Tuomo for organizing this. It's really exciting to be here. You're definitely being too kind. I don't know if the word pioneering can go anywhere near what I do, but hopefully it'll be interesting enough for this conversation. And if anybody is interested to get in touch anytime, feel free to get in touch. Also about the reading group that Theresa was mentioning, it's open to everybody and supported by the Southampton Maritime and Marine Institute. Where we run a one of the special interest group on ocean justice. So anybody is welcome to join those. So feel free to email me about it. So my PhD was on the sort of problematically called field of Latin American studies, where I feel like it's sometimes such a big word that makes a very complex region quite homogeneous. But I was really interested in extraction and how different forms of culture and politics registered and thought through extraction, particularly the extraction of colonial plantation agriculture, and how these forms of enslavement extraction that were present in the plantation can be seen to continue a neoliberal form of resource extraction, particularly oil, rubber, and in different places. And as I finished my PhD, I always wanted to work with the ocean and on the ocean more. And it was always present in some of my thoughts. But I then read about deep sea mining, which made for a helpful transition when you apply to a postdoc in terms of moving questions of extraction onto the seabed. And also animated me really because I was really mad about it. It became this interesting way to think about all these things I'd been thinking about and include the ocean more, but particularly the deep seabed outside any country's jurisdiction. So I guess that's how I started thinking with ocean scholarship at the intersection of other scholarship that I've been reading in the context of Latin American and Caribbean studies.
And I guess for anybody that might not know what blue humanities means, how would you describe blue humanities?
Yeah, that's a difficult term, I guess. And I don't know if I would always define myself as Blue Humanities, but it's definitely part of a field that's really important. So the humanities have these different ways of defining themselves and dividing. And I think the environmental humanities is the big one, and one of a sort of subcategory that looks at the environment and is more focused on water bodies is often called the Blue Humanities. And it's have been quite complex and transdisciplinary across the board. Scholars have thought about the fact that blue might be not always the best term because the sea can have many different colors and we can understand colors in different ways. So I think it's a field that interestingly think about itself critically too. And that, yeah, looks at any forms of water, whether I think based on what I've heard from other scholars as well, on ice, rivers, mud, oceans. So we can, yeah, we can
Yeah,
build
no,
on.
thank you for helping with that
Yeah.
orientation. And your work, I guess, brings, I think, of three sort of themes: the kelp forests, the seabed, and then histories of ocean geography and ocean governance in a way that seemed to kind of merge. I'd like to pick up a little bit though on that, the seabed and the governance of the seabed, because we seem to be at a really critical time in relation to seabed governance. And again, for people who might not be aware of where we're at historically at this particular moment, what's your take on the situation at this present moment in time?
Yeah, so less than a week ago, UN, United Nations mandated body called International Seabed Authority wrapped up the first sessions of their meeting in Kingston, Jamaica. This body, the International Seabed Authority, is currently negotiating to create a regulatory framework, so a document that they often call the mining code that will decide how we would mine the deep seabed outside of any country's jurisdiction, because this body has the authority over it. But at the same time, many international spaces or groups like the UN Ocean Governance Conference that happened in Nice last year, or the so-called High Seas Treaties, are also making these questions of resource extraction and governance of the seabed complicated in the way they've been all trying to codify both the issues that we environmentally face and the ocean is facing along with us and because of us, but also thinking of it as sometimes a bit of a silver bullet to solve these problems, and how carbon sequestration, so storing carbon, food pathways, clothes and materials pathways could be solved by ocean solutions, but also at the same time to potentially save itself. And that's how mining has also been framed by mining companies in some countries, that if we mine certain minerals and metals onto the seabed rather than on land, it might be more environmentally and humanly sustainable. And they often quote the sort of environmental devastation and human rights violation of the Democratic Republic of Congo as an example of where mining on the seabed might be more environmental. But the problem is the science is not really able to tell us yet if this is actually going to be the case. There's only been some levels of test mining, and a lot of scientists have sort of discussed how doing ocean, deep ocean science is really difficult because of the different environmental context, darkness, pressure, how expensive equipment is and data is. And a lot of the data and plans on the mining are extrapolated from small elements, small parts of the ocean that have been explored. So it really means that it's all very speculative when it comes to whether it'd be more sustainable. And so all these questions of ocean governance are very much under the urgency of climate crisis, which is affecting the ocean, but is also making the ocean this kind of solution for everything, and has the risk to continue what started a crisis in the first place.
Thank you for that. I think that's really sort of clearly laid out, and it's interesting, I guess, how much of this is focused on this kind of question of, sustainability. And one of the things that you do in your work is to bring in other voices that may not be those scientific voices, or may not be looking at the economic cases for it, or the kind of, let's say, formal kind of issues around it. And that, of course, relates to people who have local wisdoms about the sea or who are indigenous. And in particular, I was really struck and almost had that shiver in my spine when you shared some of this in the last few weeks with Kaisha, because actually the creation stories of some cultures actually consider that we are coming from this the seabed and the deep sea vents in particular, which also coincides in a way with actually what some scientists are discovering at this moment in time. And again, for people who may not know that work, or where are these kind of points coming to connect, and how are scientists then working alongside those that are, I guess, at the forefront of some of these questions, local cultures?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think some science and some groups are trying to push for more of that. The Deep Ocean Stewardship Initiative, or DOSI, is doing some of that work. But there is often a bit of a fracture between the language that the science uses, the language that the law and the governance is made, and then the language of these stories that, as you tell us about our origin stories and different forms of story that have been there for centuries and ancestral times, and all connect the beginning of life, but also the end of life to the seabed, whether it is where we're from or where ancestors go to rest. And it has also a very important layer of the history of transatlantic slavery, for instance, and death on the waters there. So I think these fractures sometimes reinforce some of the issues that I'm trying to explore, and that make these as stories are something other than the factual science, for instance, even though there's an attempt from some scientists to work with different communities. So I definitely don't want to put everybody in the same group. What I've been interested in and I've worked on recently is with Indigenous activists that come to the International Seabed Authority, including an activist, Salomon Kalo Ala Ala Ala, who goes by also Uncle Sol, and comes and often tells the story of the Kumulipo, which in Hawaiian means origin mystery. And it's basically an origin chant that was often created also in relation to celebrate certain lines of monarchy in the Hawaiian kingdom. But this origin chant was also translated into English around 1895, 96 by Queen Liliuokalani, who was the last reigning queen of Hawaii during the illegal occupation of the country and coup by US, German, and UK business men and powers. And it was then published in 18, I think, 97 officially. And so this translation that people can access now, and the origin song tells us that the world is born of darkness, and the first thing that is born is the coral insect or the coral polyp, and we all come from the coral polyp, and we return to the coral polyp eventually. So Uncle Sol often comes to the International Seabed Authority and tells this story in a traditional Hawaiian way through a chant and oli that also has a physical embodiment within itself. And sometimes scientists in the room find it very inspiring. Sometimes they don't, are not open to this knowledge that is as valid as theirs, and they see it as something emotional, a story. And so that's where we have those fractures that come in a discussion that is relevant for all of us, because the deep sea mining would happen outside any country's jurisdiction in what the law of the sea calls common heritage of all mankind. So all of ours.
Thank you. And I mean, it's, I guess it's quite profound, the layers there that have been addressed in your answer. How important do you find these effective strategies? You know, if you wanted to kind of almost call it that, you know, somebody might say it's too emotional, or somebody might say it's exactly the soul that we need to bring into these kind of conversations because there's been such a big disconnect. And what I was struck in the last few days in reading some of your publications was actually how you use different methodologies to sort of write us back, you know, to bring us back into that kind of connection, really, in a way. And one of those methods that you spoke about is tidaletics. And I
Dialectic,
was tidalectics. Yeah, I love it because all of the guests that we're bringing in the next kind of couple of months have all these wonderful watery ways to describe things. And so what way are you using this tidalectics? And what does it mean for again, for people who might be tuning in that are not familiar with this method?
yeah. So the word comes from Barbadian philosopher, thinker, and author Kamal Brathwaite, who in a conversation, an interview with I think Nathaniel K, McKay, Nathaniel Mackay, discussed tidalectics. And as the kind of work that a lot of Caribbean authors do, like Kamal Brathwaite, but also other authors like Frantz Fanon, Aimé Césaire, more recently Malcolm Ferdinand, are often beyond, I think, simple theory. they can be quite poetic and transdisciplinary, the same way Christina Sharp writes and brings in theory with practice with life. And so it's often, and in the case of Brathwaite's and dialectics, it's very poetic in a way, the way he unpacks this concept, which looks at the fact that, according to him, he says our minds, so this expand, I guess, to Caribbean minds, our minds are not dialectic, they are tidialectic. And so he kind of builds on this sort of Western philosophical understanding that you always get two parts of a debate, two parts of a conversation, and that one part only sort of wins, and that sometimes there's no building on each other or building knowledge, and it's quite linear in that sense. And so tidialectic kind of breaks this apart by looking at the movement of tides and water on a beach that comes and erases what has come but doesn't really erase it. And so it can be interpreted in many ways. So this is by no way a perspective, prescriptive understanding, but which would limit it in the first place, I think, if I was to say this is the definition. But a lot of scholars have thought with it as a way to think through not only how circular and continuous certain knowledge formations and epistemes are, but also history itself as a way to being cyclical and repetitive in different form rather than a linear enlightenment progress of, constant forward coming. So tidialectics brings in these kind of more complex ways of thinking, and particularly foregrounds the sea and the environment as ways in which we are, because we are part of these environments and they are part of us. And so any thinking is also built with them, I guess.
And I'd like to sort of swing that back then to the work that you've been doing on justice and governance in a way, because if we think about the law divides things into sort of personhood and property in a way, and that is useful and it's detriment all at the same time, really, in a way. And this very, I guess, applying those branches to the sea already feels counterintuitive. And I guess that's your point really with kind of using trying to bring in these poetics or metaphors or sea ways to think that we're always sort of changing. I mean, having bumped up to some of this legal scholarship that's trying to think about more than human ways of stewardship and being with the earth in different ways and the sea. Where is your work standing at this particular point on those aspects? And with this very kind of, I guess, new regulations coming in with the ocean, there is on one level massive potential to reimagine what we think about as the governance structures, but then at the same time, we're already very quickly going into the tropes of ownership, borderlines, square plots. And applying a logic that is military, really, that doesn't work upon a big, fluid, open, messy other world, really, a world that is not our world. So where do you sort of see the work regarding rethinking law at this moment in time?
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not a legal scholar, obviously, so I build here on a lot of other legal scholars whose work I really admire, particularly on the one hand, Fluke Adebisi, who's a lecturer in law at the University of Bristol and looks at how he's written a book on decolonizing legal knowledge and really looks at the law as a Western colonial construct that was built to maintain colonial practices and continue to make some people as less important, as less able to have rights than others. But also Surabhi Ranganathan at the University of Cambridge, who has been working on the law of the sea for many years and has written about issues relating to decolonizing the law of the sea. And but it is a bit of a standstill where it seems impossible to, in a way, imagine these alternatives, these alternative governance, because the law in itself forecloses that. It tells us that the duty and the mandate of the International Seabed Authority is to create a mining code within it. It has a mandate to try and protect the environment, but as far as mining still happens. So these set of rules means that we're already in a specific conversation. And it's a conversation that, as you say, doesn't work in this fluid space. But at the same time, capitalism has used the fluid space of the ocean, put it to work for its own interest, right? So the ambiguity that it creates materially, but also epistemologically, has been used, I think, to achieve certain things. And it makes the conversation more difficult. So I think we are at a point where it's really hard to think beyond these structures because they're there. But a lot of different groups that are often described as activists are doing a lot of work to think beyond that. And I'm saying described as activists because I think in some cases, particularly for different First Nation and Indigenous group, what they're doing is beyond activism. It is governance as well, but it's just not recognized as such because they're not seen as sovereign of a state if their country has been subsumed by former colonizers, like the case of Apa'i that I was talking about before, by the US, Tahiti in the Pacific from France. Or they might not be represented. There might be several indigenous groups within a country. So Aotearoa New Zealand has more support for the indigenous group and they have river personhood rights there, stewarded by Maori groups. But the people who may represent Aotearoa New Zealand on the negotiation table at the ISA might not represent all of these groups. And even us in the room who may not be First Nation or Indigenous people might not agree with the people representing us into that room. So I think there's a big disjunction there in who gets to make these decisions and how.
And I guess we all know, even if we just take it to a very like basic level, who gets to speak in any room at any time is such a mix of, confidences and bravados and egos and knowledges and power and all of those things. And I can imagine it's quite complex then in a way. One of the things that struck me actually when we were having a conversation also with Kaisha Mulga, the artist who joined us a few weeks ago, was actually how in a way this sort of turn towards the ocean is very present in humanities and in literature and in many different fields of practice at this particular moment in time. And I think you even said, the ocean is having its moment in a way, which is actually a very beautiful calling. I think also that this water body is telling us, come on, you do some work, humans. You've it's gone the other way. So energetically, I feel like we're hearing the ocean at least a little bit. But how many other things on the earth are sort of categorized in this common heritage for humankind classification, so to speak? Because in the end of the day, it's a classification that we're working with. So what else would be there is one question. And the other is, what exactly is being mined in a way, or what is this speculative mining imaginary that has been activated?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I hadn't actually thought about what else I think. So the way the language is noted in the Law of the Sea particularly applies specifically on the seabed and the high seas beyond national jurisdiction. So countries have internal waters, territorial waters, and then they have something called economic exclusive zones where they may undertake business. And those go up to 200 nautical miles from the lower baseline of the coast, essentially. And beyond that, where there's no other country that has their territorial and economic exclusive zones and waters, there is this high seas international water space. And in the case of the Law of the Sea, that created then the International Seabed Authority to negotiate these discussions, that seems to fall particularly on the seabed and what they call the resource. Well, it's called the area, first of all, which is, as a brilliant scholar called Susan Reid says, a very unimaginative term to make similar anything beyond these 200 nautical miles. But it's a very complex space that we still don't know much about. And it's called the area, and it tells us that this area is the seabed and subsoil thereof, and any of the resources there are made to be are the activity. So, and then the activities in the law of the seas are any kind of exploration and exploitation of the resources of the seabed and the subsoil thereof. So I think in terms of common heritage, that is what is defined as such. It is important to say that even though the word heritage brings in a lot of different imaginaries, what is meant in that case is a benefit sharing heritage. So we should all benefit from it. It's not a heritage in the sense of the UNESCO heritage, cultural heritage, for instance, which already creates, I think, an important friction in the debate. So it means that we all get to exploit it, but it doesn't tell us how we should all be responsible for it. So I think there's already a problem there that is really important to unpack. And then for what is being mined, so in these waters that are outside any country's jurisdiction are many different ecosystems. And it's really interesting that you ask because a lot of the deep sea mining discussion have made one specific ecosystem and one specific quote unquote resource their poster child. So people often associate deep sea mining with polymetallic nodules, which are often described as potato shaped rocks. They're not, they're formation that take millennia to create out of sort of waste at the bottom of the sea, including a shark tooth, a shell, etc. And they grow and they become these complex geological formation that include many minerals, such as copper, manganese, rare earth minerals, iron. And essentially, they are on deep sea abyssal plains. And often, when people give example of deep sea mining, they show automated rover just gathering them on the surface in this emptied space of the seabed where nothing else and no one else is. And they make it very simple how mining might take place in this kind of very animated science fiction image of the deep sea. But there are other ecosystems that would be mined as well, and that are part of the discussion, including the hydrothermal vents that you were talking about at the beginning, where life might have come from, where they would clip and break parts of the vents to extract minerals, or sea mounds, which are mountains under the sea, at various depths.
And I remember when we were also chatting a few weeks ago, even the imaginaries of how this is going to be mined, like sucking and pulling, and I think most of them were being sucked up. You said the, potato kind of nodules, so to speak, and that this is already like, a fake, rendition of like what it could like look like because it disturbs so many elements in a way. I mean, I feel we could kind of go on for ages about, some of this and we're trying to really support these almost like lunchtime kind of conversations really in a way. But I kind of wanted to just close on that element of regarding the mining in a sense. So what I'm taking from my learnings actually over the last almost couple of weeks in engaging with your work and others that are in this space is that there is a high level of speculative fiction that's going on, but rendered in these, great kind of colonial ways, we could sort of say. And I think you pointed to how that's kind of working itself out in all these different rules and regulations. But what kind of brought you to, I mean, you mentioned it from a sort of professional perspective, what brought you to the ocean, but I also am aware that you're a diver, and many people that we're speaking to in this conversation have very watery lives beyond the desk in a way. And I thought it would be nice to sort of maybe close on that because, you shared really what that as a practice actually brings to you in terms of a, I guess, a concord or a commune. And one of the wonderful things that the elemental program has been doing, I guess, from my personal perspective, is bringing me into this conversation with earth and with water in a really like vibrant way that actually almost somatically I can sometimes feel change is happening because I'm thinking with those elements in a way. And so what's diving or what does diving do those things for you, or is it actually something that is just for pleasures?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of both. I love the sea. I love being in the sea. I was fortunate to grow up by the sea in a safe way because I know the sea has not been safe for many people and it continues not to be. If we think about the Mediterranean and migration, but the long history of transatlantic slavery as well. But because I grew up by it and with it, I just love it. And I wanted an excuse to think more with it, but also to make my work think about what are better ways to engage with it for all of us. Because it made sense for me for my work to be also more engaged with these questions, I think. And so swimming, diving, snorkeling, I've always been a ways to think with the ocean. And I think it's important, as you were saying, because it's a world that seems different than ours and requires different ways of thinking. Engaging with it in different ways is also important. Diving is both extremely exciting and can teach us so much, like the work of Melody Jew as well as shown, as well as other scholars. But it is also coming with a certain privilege because it's an expensive technical style of engagement, unlike swimming or snorkeling or diving, like free diving, for instance. So I think, but it really helps us to think in different ways. Some of my colleagues do it also in a way to build empathy and to challenge how we understand the ocean and the fears that might be related to it. But always try to do it also in different respectful ways. And so I've been very fortunate to work with people who engage with these spaces as well, like that, and be part of many collaborative projects, and meet other sort of eth divers who do it in that sense, rather than as a tourism element, for instance.
And I'd actually just like to end with actually the kelp forests, because there's this, we've been speaking a lot through the lens, I guess, of governance and law and legislations, and the kelp forest just sparks so much imagination. And I think it would be really nice to leave the conversation with that impression on our minds. So, is there a story you'd like to share from your adventures with kelp forests, or share even some of the work that you're doing in that space, and tell us what kelp forest is again, because perhaps maybe some people will not know. And yeah.
Yes. So yeah, the deep sea mining work I've been doing is separate from the kelp work, but they're all related because they're very ocean bound and I'm really interested in these places. A lot of the deep sea mining work, especially the tidelectric ones that you also mentioned, is also done in collaboration with a group called the Deep Currents Collective. We used to have a website, so we would have told you to look at it, but we had a little accident with it. So at the moment, I think it might be down, but you could still Google us and find some more information. The kelp work on the other end is based with brilliant colleagues in South Africa in particular, and a couple also in the UK. And it started with this collaboration with some of my colleagues there in South Africa, including Mia Strand, Louise Odunga, Apiwe Moshane, Akshata Mehta. Akshata Mehta has a beautiful film called South Africa's Golden Forest on kelp, which is really quick. It's really short and on YouTube, free for all. So I would suggest exploring it if anybody's interested. And Nasreen Pierce. And this group of scholars and I have been trying to set up a research project on the socio-ecological relationship of peoples in False Bay, a bay in Cape Town, South Africa, to kelp forests. So kelp forests are sort of in different parts of the world. There's many of them. Most of them have been quite affected by climate change, but the one in Cape Town is actually doing fairly well. It's often called the Great African Sea Forest. And it's ecosystems that you would find in out of some parts of the UK, Peru, Chile, California, and other parts of the world. And they're one of the biggest sort of seagrass elements. I'm not a scientist, so I'll be mistranslating that, but they're rooted giant forests through that serves as nursery for many juvenile species and play a lot of important sort of so-called ecosystemic services. They capture carbon, they can be used for textile making, they can be eaten, etc. And swimming in kelp forests, whether it's through diving or free diving, is always an amazing experience, as I was lucky to be able to do it a few times in Cape Town. And you see often small sharks like pajama sharks and other different ecosystem. And the reason that specific forest is doing quite well is because there's an intersection of waters that happen there, from cold flows from the Antarctic and warm flows from the north. And the warming ocean has meant that it's been expanding actually, but then it also encroaches on other ecosystems. So that means it's a very complex space to think through. And different communities had different relationship to it, but because of colonial histories and apartheid, spatial imperial spatial planning and the violence that came with it, a lot of people were disconnected and moved away from the coast. So a lot of this work that we're trying to set up and do is about thinking how these long sociocological relations can be brought back to different, to the marine spatial planning and governmental and sociocultural relations.
Yeah, beautiful. So the kelp forest is helping us to be entangled in new ways in this work. Yeah, great. Thank you so
Yeah.
much.
And as I was speaking, I saw there was a comment about Emma Critchley's work. And yes, I would definitely recommend Emma's work. It's amazing. Not just the link soundings that you send, but she also made a film that she started a long time ago, but finished in 2019, called Common Heritage, which is exactly about common heritage of mankind and all of the deep sea mining work I've been talking about. So I would highly recommend any of her work, which is being shown at different galleries across the UK.
Brilliant. Julia, I just want to say on behalf of Kubu and the Social Practice Lab at Winchester School of Art at the Uni of Southampton, I just want to say thank you so much. It's just wonderful to have these vibrant scholars thinking so much about oceans and water bodies and to be able to bring you into this conversation as well. And I also just really appreciate the many ways in which you referenced and called out people, and I think that it might be worth us also just thinking out loud now of adding the names and the references, because I really appreciate it how you think in this sort of expansive way, and we see a lot of love hearts coming through. So yeah, thank you so much for leaving us. I'll Tuomo, we should just say like the next session for those that are tuning in is on the 16th of April. Also, same link, 1:30, and then in May, on the 21st of May, in April, we will have the wonderful Andreas, who's the director of the Westminster Legal Theory Group, who also has written on hydro justice, and also will be bringing his thinking into the space. And in May, we have Kajil Modi, who will be speaking about her work on stories from the water and water pollution and microbial research as well. And she's coming also from graphic design. So yeah, thanks to everybody. Julia, thanks for your time again, and see you all soon.
Thanks for
Bye.
having me. Thank you, everyone. Have a nice day.